thanking all of the organizers for putting on a really good workshop. It's been very nice. So what I'm going to speak about is a joint project with Kenji Nakanishi and Taiping Tsai. So the equation I'm looking at today is just this one. In fact, it's nothing but a usual nonlinear Schrodinger equation. I'm going to take my function on Rn space. But what makes the situation a little bit different than our usual nonlinear Schrodinger study is the boundary conditions we put on. So the boundary conditions here have the modulus of psi tending to 1 at the boundary. So in this case, at spatial infinity. So this object here has various names. It's sometimes called the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Also sometimes called Ginzburg-Landau. Or Ginzburg-Landau Schrodinger equation. And it's supposed to be a model in various physical situations, so for superfluids, for example. It's a model in superconductivity. Other things. Okay, so some very basic facts about this equation. First of all, there's a conserved energy functional. Designed to take into account these boundary conditions. So for finite energy, means the modulus of psi has to tend to 1 at infinity in some sense. So this is conserved. That's the first simple observation. The second simple observation is that there are some trivial static solutions, which are just constant solutions. Anything which is a constant of modulus 1. So anything in the unit circle. So this is sometimes called, a solution of this form is sometimes called a vacuum. Okay, so what's known about this equation? Actually, quite a lot of interesting things, and there's been a lot of, especially in recent years, a lot of work on this kind of equation. Let me list a few highlights. So the first thing to mention is so-called vortex solutions. So a vortex is a static solution of this equation, which looks like this. There's a radially symmetric function f, and then a phase which rotates in x with the angle theta m times, where m is some integer. So m here is plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, so on. So what's the picture? So fm here vanishes at the origin, and tends to 1 at infinity. So that means a vortex is kind of a localized disturbance in, this is all for n equals 2 so far. So this is in two space dimensions. So it's some localized disturbance in space. The modulus is tends to 1 at infinity. And then there's some rotation or winding number depending on this integer m. So if I look near the origin, then a vortex, a degree 1 vortex, for example, will look something like this. So this is referred to as an M vortex. Then there's the question of, these are static solutions of the equation. They're basic structures which appear in the physics applications. Are they stable or not? Well, there's at least a picture about this. So the M vortex should be stable in some sense if the degree is plus or minus 1, and unstable otherwise. Yes. That's right. So soon I'll make additional assumptions about how we're going to one. Yeah. This theta here is this is just the polar angle. Theta of x. So here, this is r theta in R2. It's just polar coordinates. Okay, so low degree vortices are supposed to be stable, higher degree vortices unstable, and this is known in some weak sense, so in spectral sense. Meaning one looks at the eigenvalues of the linearized operator and sees where they live. So this is not really a dynamical, nonlinear dynamical notion of stability yet. So that's vortices. These are static solutions. Another thing that's known to exist is traveling waves. Traveling wave solutions. So these are solutions which just translate in one spatial direction as a function of time. The existence of such traveling waves is proved by Betuel and So. That's, I don't know, about 99 maybe. And qualitatively, what these traveling waves look like is a vortex pair. So I have a vortex of degree, let's say, plus 1 here, minus 1 here, and then the whole thing translates as a function of time. Well, maybe I got the direction wrong, but one way or the other way. And this, the this is a variational argument. It's a mountain pass. And the distance here should be sufficiently large. So that's the 2D picture. What about higher dimensions? Well, let's look at n equals 3, for example. One could also look at higher dimensions. Actually, there's something else I want to say about n equals 2 first. So there's been a whole lot of work on this, what you might call the singular limit problem. So we take our Gross-Pitayevsky and we put a small parameter in it, epsilon, in front of the nonlinearity, 1 over epsilon squared in front of the nonlinearity. And ask what happens as epsilon goes to 0. And the picture, very roughly, is this, that these vortices, which have some spatial structure, collapse down to points. So vortices become points in this limit. And then as a function of time, they have a certain finite dimensional dynamics. So this, let's see, so for the statics part of this picture, the sort of pioneering work was Bethwell, Perezis, Elon, something like 94. And there's many others involved in this. And for dynamics, in particular for the Schrodinger type equation, this was studied by Coleander and Gerard. And Lin and Jin. Something like 98, 99. So that's all in two dimensions. Let me just quickly mention higher dimensions. So let's take the n equals 3 case. In this case, vortices are not like point objects. They're like string or curved objects. So you get, instead of point vortices, you get something like vortex filaments. So in three dimensions, you might see something like this. This is supposed to be a circle, a filament, around which you always have some topological winding, like you do for the vortex. So again, it's known that there are traveling wave solutions that look something like this, where if I get this right, this circle should just parallel translate in space. This was done by Bethwell, Orlandi, and Smets recently. I'm not sure, maybe this year. And also the dynamics of these filaments in this sort of singular limit was studied by Bob Girard. Something like 03, studied the filament dynamics. So that's all by way of background, what's known for this Gross-Pitayevsky type equation. So the question I want to address here concerns the long time behavior. So what happens to solutions for long time? So an example of such a question would be the question of whether the static vortex is asymptotically stable. So is plus or minus one vortex asymptotically stable. One could ask similar questions for traveling waves. So, as far as we can tell, not too much is known about this asymptotic in time behavior. And in fact, these problems I describe here look quite difficult. And if you think about this for a short time, you realize that it's not even clear what happens in the very simplest situation. And that's when you have low energy. So all of these pictures I drew are really high energy configurations. These vortices are well separated, that means high energy. The vortex carries a certain amount of energy. So what I want to look at here is something very simple, namely just solutions near a vacuum. So that means we take psi as a perturbation of 1. Okay, pick one vacuum. 1 is good. And let's consider small perturbations of 1. Okay, so what's the equation for this perturbation U? So just plug it in. We have I du dt minus Laplace U plus, and then the nonlinear term, where's my equation? Okay, it's gone, becomes 2U1 plus U squared 1 plus U. So I'm writing U out. When I write U1, that's just the real part of U. The imaginary part will be U2. And it's this equation which I want to consider for the rest of the talk. It's a simple equation for the perturbation U. Okay, so let's start by seeing what we can get from the simplest considerations. So, for example, what do we get from energy? So the energy, when I change to U, is just grad U squared. And then 2U1 plus U squared squared. So what does this give me in the way of control? Well, from the gradient term, obviously, we get the control of the gradient in L2, so U in H1 dot, which by embedding gives us some LP. And then the other term, which is kind of the funny term, what does it tell us? So we have 2U1 plus U squared in L2, so that will give us what? So U1 is L2 and U squared, well, we gain a little bit here on here. So this gives us L2 plus L n over n minus 2. So we get something extra for the real part. The imaginary part we only have in this LP space. And already, this highlights what seems to be just a basic feature of this equation, which is that the real part and the imaginary part, they're not on an equal footing. The real part has better spatial decay. So U1 has better spatial decay than U2. See that already from the energy. What else? Okay, so the other simple thing you can do is just do energy estimates. And that will give you well-posedness. Of this equation star with H1 theta. And for the L2 norm, you have something like linear growth in time. So this was already remarked on by Betzwell and Stone in their paper on traveling waves. So there's no problem with well-posedness. Okay, so we want to know something a little bit more. So the goal here is to say something about the asymptotic behavior. So we're looking for, rather than growth, we're looking for some decay or scattering behavior. Okay, so in order to understand the long-time dynamics, we first have to understand the dynamics of the linear part, which is a little bit strange. So let's look first at the linearized equation. It's almost like the usual Schrodinger equation, but with this extra piece of the real part. So to see what this what's going on here, it's sort of useful to split up the real and imaginary parts. So let's put u1, u2 into a vector, and then this equation reads du vector dt is an operator L applied to vector u, where this linearized operator is the following. So up here I have minus Laplacian. Down here I have minus Laplacian plus 2 with a minus sign. And the property about this operator which troubles us is that it's not skew adjoint. So it's not like a usual Schrodinger equation. So the obvious thing to do is to diagonalize or to change variables. So you can conjugate this linear operator L by an appropriate operator. So that's something like identity up here, an operator U, which I'll describe in a moment, down here. So let's conjugate L by this guy. And then you get something which is skew adjoint. So let me tell you what these operators are. Transformation U is just minus Laplacian plus 2 inverse square root. So on Fourier space, this corresponds to multiplication by C length over 1 plus C squared square root. So this operator damps out low frequencies. And the H, this effective Hamilton, this new Hamiltonian, if you want, is just this guy. Minus Laplace plus 2 square root. So now if I write a new variable, let's call it W, complex function, which is this matrix applied to U. So I'll get U1 plus I capital U2. So I damp out the low frequency part of the imaginary part of U. Then W solves what looks like a more standard Schrodinger equation. I dW dt. So this is just, again, just the linear part, is HW. So this is the linear equation. And if you want to see how the nonlinear parts look, let me write the nonlinear terms here. It's best to write them in terms of U. And this operator, capital U, enters. So these are the nonlinear terms. Okay, so U kind of makes things better, but remember that U is not W. W is already a smoothed out or an improved version of U. So you gain here, but you lose in the U's. Okay, so I guess I can now finally state the result. About the asymptotic behavior. Now the sad fact is that so far we can only deal with higher dimensions. Five and above for the time being. This is certainly a situation that would be nice to improve. Okay, so let me state the theorem in a couple of pieces. So first let's do the n equals 6 case, which is pretty easy to state. And I won't bother writing it. Higher than 6 is similar. So the result for 6 dimensions is that let's state everything just in terms of W. So the result is that if I take W small in H2, then I can estimate the solution for later times in H2, so L infinity in time H2, and in some space-time, some Stuttgart space, so L2 in time, and then here I have H2, 3. So that's two derivatives and integrability exponent 3. So this is controlled by the initial theta. And as a consequence of this estimate, you can get a scattering type result. So if I look at W of T, then at large time, for large times, this should look like this linear evolution. So it should look like e to the minus ith times some scattering profile W plus. Large time. So H23, that's Sobolev space with two derivatives, 3. So this guy, I guess, is what you might also write as W23. Five-dimensional statement is a little bit messier because spaces are a little bit messier. similar statement. Sorry, is there a, W plus is just some W plus in H. There exists, so the statement is there exists such a W. Small, well, we know some things about it. I mean, it's small, it's this size. That's it. Yeah. Sure. So in five dimensions is a similar statement, but we live in a slightly different space. So here we're going to have W in, say, L infinity time, and let me get the indices right. This space which I have to define, minus 1/2, 3/2. So the definition here of H A B, this is H A, so it's a homogeneous Sobolev space intersects with another homogeneous Sobolev space. So the low exponent tells you the behavior, the low frequency behavior, the high exponent, the high frequency behavior, or the regularity. Okay, so that's the statement. Pardon me? That's right, yeah. In six dimensions, we need H2 to control, say, cubic terms in the nonlinearity. I don't want to make any claims about optimality of anything, so this is just what we can do on first pass. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's true for any dimension. But there, you don't see anything about... Oh, okay, yes. Okay, so the... what am I saying? Okay, so right. So the well-posedness, which comes from energy estimates, you need to up the regularity as you go to higher dimensions. Yeah. Sure. So yeah. Fine. Okay. So this is this is a result stated for the W. We started with a different function, the U. So what does this mean for U? What space are we in? Well, to figure out what space we're in, we have to look at the mapping properties of this U. So remember that the real parts of U and W are the same. The imaginary part has an operator U. So here I have to put U inverse. And U inverse will map H to AB. So what will it do? It will bump the low frequency behavior up by 1 power. So this means in six dimensions, U will be in. U1 will be in H2, U2 will be in H12, and in five dimensions, U1 is in this space, H minus 1/2, 3/2, U2 is in so we just bump this up by 1/2, 3/2. So again, this is what you expect. You expect the imaginary part to live in a worse space than the real part. That's the first remark. So the second remark is, what about lower dimensions? So obviously one would like to do 3 and 4 dimensions. So this is, we're working on this now, but we have nothing so far. This is the next step. Two dimensions, which is also very interesting from the physical point of view. Here there's some kind of obstacle. So in particular, you probably should not expect decay, at least without restricting your space somewhat, because there should be low energy traveling waves. I don't think that's proof, or I don't know that that's proof, but that's the picture in the physics literature. So in two dimensions, that this fact would have to be, if you're considering low energy solutions, you have to take into account also solitary waves. Running out of time, let me just say what's the key ingredient here. It's what you would expect. It's linear decay estimates. And the claim is that we have estimates of the following sort for this operator H. So first, decay estimates. Well, here I have a very similar situation to the usual Schrodinger equation. So if I look at LQ here, I have some time decay. I put out Q prime, and so sigma here is the usual 1 over 2 minus 1 over Q. Ah, this is not quite right. So the important difference here is I pick up a factor of U in here to a certain power. So I think the power is, let me check the power, n minus 2 times sigma. So this is U, n minus 2 times sigma. Okay. Together with, okay, so once you have these decay estimates, then you also have the corresponding Stricard's estimates. And, okay, so somehow the key point is the appearance of this U. So we get some gain in the estimates here from U. Remember, U is like a low frequency damping. And we really need this. In fact, we don't need it for 6 dimensions, but for 5 dimensions, we really need to exploit this gain here. So the obviously there's no time for details, but the proof is some kind of what you would expect, some kind of stationary phase arc. Okay, so I'm out of time. I'll stop.